Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations stance point. With your host, Dan Rennie.
Welcome to Let's Talk. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land here where we broadcast from in the west end of Brisbane. Also pay respects to elders past and present. And thank you for tuning in. It's great to have your company. Well, it's great to have this gentleman in the studio with us live today. Paul Richards, welcome to Let's Talk.
Thank you, Dan. Lovely to be here.
As we do, and as is custom, can we start with your mob, your country? Where are you from?
My ancestry is from Cornwall.
Right.
And around about the age of 21 or so, I got captured by the Noonuckle of Stradbroke Island, who then put me to work. And I still haven't stopped bloody working. So, but that was my first close contact and belonging with Oodgeroo and her family and the rest of the Noonuckle.
Tell us a little bit about your story. You touched on it there with blackfellas, but your connection with blackfellas in this country is a long one, and it stretches right back. But yeah, tell us how you came to be, I suppose, adopted by the mob.
Well, I'll start a little bit back, because over the vintage that I was called up for national service to go to Vietnam, and I checked it out and found out that it was actually a war of independence against the French. And because the Vietnamese kept beating the French, they called the Americans in to help. And then the Americans called us in to help, and 500 Australians went to die to help the French keep their economic power in Southeast Asia, which was what it was about. So because I was objecting, and I was running an amateur theatre group, so we started doing a lot of anti-war theatre and stuff like that. And I went round one day to visit a theatre director to talk to him about theatre things. While I was talking to him, suddenly Vivian Walker came into the room. Now, Vivian was a choreographer, a dancer, an actor, an artist, and he was probably about 16 or something at the time. But he was tremendously self-confident, aware and intelligent and bright and extraordinary. So that was my first meeting. Then a couple of weeks later, I ran into him in the city by chance, and we went and had a coffee and a long talk about the theatre and all that sort of stuff. And in which case, he told me that his mother was Kath Walker, now known as Oodgeroo Noonuckle. And so then he got into our theatre group. And one time he just said, "Oh, why don't you come home and meet my mum?" So I went home, and anyone who met Kath Walker, as she then was, would just find her the most extraordinary woman. She's the most incredibly powerful, intelligent, articulate woman I'd ever met. And so I was enchanted. Now, I then got more involved with the family, and I remember spending, I think it was 1968 or 69 at the latest, I was invited to Christmas Day at their home. And so it was all the Noonuckle, the Coolwells, and all the Noonuckle from Stradbroke Island. Mm. So, but I remember one funny part of it was that at one stage everyone left the room except me and Sid Coolwell. And Sid was, a good bit older than me. He's long gone now. But and so trying to think of what to say, and I said to him, Sid, do you see much racism around then? Of course, now I know what a ridiculously stupid question that was.
Yeah.
But he was very polite, and he just said, "Oh, no, not really," and he sort of popped it off like that.
Yeah.
But as time went on, I learnt more and more of the appalling, appalling conditions of Aboriginal people at that time. And crimes against humanity, just utter disgrace. But so then Dennis came back from being in the Merchant Navy, Dennis Walker, her eldest son, and because he was also incredible. And so I got very close with them, and then not long, around about the same time, 68, I think it was, they started Tribal Council. So by sheer coincidence, the theatre group I was operating was in La Trobe Terrace, Paddington. We had a big old house we'd converted into a sort of live-in theatre place. So then Tribal Council moved in next door to us. And so we wound up having a lot of, you know, joint parties and, you know, working in with each other and being friends with each other and stuff like that. And then I started doing some theatre workshops with the young fellas from Tribal Council, particularly Don Brady's children.
Yep.
And so then it sort of went from there, because then one day we did some theatre workshops, and you know how you improvise in theatre, especially with kids, they act out their life experience. So I went next door one day to Tribal Council and said, these kids are telling me terrible things. They're acting out all this stuff about, you know, terrible landlords and police and school teachers and all this sort of... And curiously enough, they're also acting out stuff about social workers. And it never occurred to me that social workers could be evil. But they were the ones that were taking the kids away and stuff like that. So, and I said, look, all this stuff they're telling me, this is terrible. What's happening? And they said, well, we've got... the Dean of the Faculty at Queensland University, Zelman Cowan, he's supposed to be trying to organise something. So as a sort of semi-dropout student, law student, I went to see him. And he said, oh, well, first of all, we have to consult with the Bar Association, the Law Society, the Department of Justice, the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, all these things. I went back there and said, don't wait for him, it'll happen forever. Mm-hmm. I said, I'll tell you what, why don't we organise a meeting out at the uni, I'll find all the lawyers I can get that are willing to help voluntary, and you get all your mob together, we'll have a big meeting and so see something out. So Cheryl Buchanan actually organised the meeting. And it it had followed, 71 was the Springbok demonstrations, where we were protesting about South Africa, which then meant we all started saying, but what are we doing here anyway? If we're protesting about racism in South Africa, what's going on here? And so then at the beginning of February 72, students had a conference against racism at the uni, and it was from that meeting that we then organised the lawyers and Tribal Council to get together, and then we set up a committee at the beginning of 72, and sort of from there it's gone on and on. And in fact, it's the 50th anniversary this year.
Mm.
The doors were open at the Legal Service in December 72. I've had a yarn with the Legal Service people. What they're doing, I think they're correct in this. They said they're not going to have a big party or a big celebration, because when you think about it, nearly all of the people who were involved at that time are all gone now anyway. And it'd just be the newcomers all having a party. And, you know. So instead what they're doing, and I'm helping with this, they're doing a history project where they'll be on their website. You can click on to their website and get the history of it all there in much more detail and you know, as part of the education. Mm. And I hope they'll put it through schools and that sort of thing too. So that's where it's up to now.
Unbelievable. Mm. You're also an author, Paul.
Yes.
And I was lucky enough to bump into you some months back, and you handed me a copy of this, and the front cover is... a photo of you some years ago, 86 in fact. Mm-hmm. Big fluffy hair and and of course a big gash down the front of your forehead.
Yes.
This book is called Adventures with Agitators, Stories of Indigenous Australia, and I'll tell you what, it's a great read. I had a wonderful time reading this, but look, some amazing stories in there. And if you didn't know they were true, you know, you'd say some of this stuff is unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you first of all about the photograph on the front of the book. That's my watch house photograph.
Mm.
And you know, a couple of weeks ago, we sadly lost Mop from Mop and the Dropouts. And not before that, we lost Angus Rabbit. And before that, more recently, we lost Bimbo Duncan.
Mm.
So that band was very much a part of my life. And they were all great friends of mine. And on a particular night in 86, the Brisbane natives had a party in the hall of at Rose Lee, the RSL Hall, and the band were Mop and the Dropouts. Now, in 86, there was going to be an election in a few months after this date, at which they were still the Country Party.
Mm.
By the way, they changed their name from Country Party to National Party to protect the guilty.
Yes.
Anyway, this election was the idea was that the Country Party wanted to get be a sufficient number to govern in their own right without having to go into partnership with the Liberals. And so I reckon they organised this because around about 10 o'clock at night, they came and they demanded that they seize the musical instruments for breaching the Noise Abatement Act. Now, it wasn't that loud. It was a setup, the whole thing. Mm. And so when they wanted to take the mop and the dropout's instruments, there was a bit of a scuffle and that sort of thing. So some cop, their story was that they sent out a message, a policeman down, all hands on deck sort of thing. So 100 police from all around Brisbane converged on that hall, and they jumped out and they ran in with batons and dogs and attacked women and children and men and everybody, and herded them into vans, and it was just unbelievable. It looked exactly like what you used to see in South Africa.
Yeah, wow.
And it was dreadful. So I actually left early because it was fairly quiet and I didn't want to get drunk, so I'll go home. So I was down the road in Milton Road trying to get a cab, and saw all these police cars coming from everywhere. So I jumped in the cab and said, take me down to the hall. So I got down the hall, got out of the cab, and you couldn't believe what was happening. It was just batons and dogs everywhere bashing people and stuff. And so I went in to find someone in charge. Nobody would admit to being in charge. And so then a woman came up to me and said she'd lost her child. So I said, well, tell you what, I'll walk back in there with you to find your child and we'll get the child out. So we did that, and we were walking back out, and this great big burly fat cop stood in the middle of the footpath to prevent us from walking away. Mm. And so we sort of walked around him. As we got past him, she said to me, what was he on about? And I said, he just had to be a nuisance or something. It wasn't terribly serious, and I just brushed it off sort of thing. I go around the corner out of sight. There were TV cameras everywhere, by the way.
They let the
TV know to be there.
Yes.
Because they wanted it on TV to frighten people in a law and order thing to vote more conservatively.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was around the corner out of sight, and next thing, wham, bam, I'm thrown around and banged up against the petrol bowser, and they threw me in the van too. So I've got this blood running down my face. And by the way, I only thought about this more recently. They put me in a van by myself, whereas everybody else was herded in together,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was an odd thing. And you think about it, I think they might have thought I might have stirred up more trouble. Anyway, so I get to the watch house, and there's like several hundred people in the watch house. And the joke that everyone always tells is that they would say, we're going to get our lawyer onto you. We're going to get Paul Richards onto you. And then the cop says, oh, yeah, he's in the next cell. and so, of course, from my point of view, I'm terribly proud of that.
Yes.
I mean, they were just assholes. You know, are we allowed to say that on radio?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
That's what happened in that situation. Now, the word agitators comes from Yarrabah. Percy Neal is a good mate of mine. I was up at his father's 100th birthday party on the weekend. And Percy was the mayor of Yarrabah. And he decided, quite wisely, that they had white people working there at Yarrabah who had no particular skill or ability. And so he said, well, what we're going to do, we're going to aboriginalise the workforce. Where we've got someone like a storekeeper, for example, who's not got no particular skill, we'll train one of our own mob to take that job over and get rid of him. So because he was doing that, the government set him up on a charge of spitting on a white man. And he didn't spit on the guy at all, but it was set up on the way to get him convicted.
Mm.
So then it went before a magistrate. And by the way, you have to remember in those days, the magistrates were not lawyers. They were public servants who worked their way up in the public service by being obedient to the government.
Mm.
So when you went to court, if the police said something and the citizens said the opposite, they always believed the police. And it was even worse with Aboriginal people. Aboriginal people didn't have a hope in hell of getting a magistrate to give them the benefit of the doubt. And so this magistrate found Percy guilty. And then when he was sentencing him, he said, any Aboriginal who agitates for change in the Aboriginal community deserves, as a sentencing principle, to be more seriously punished. Now, that's despite the fact that anyone in their right mind would say that 1980 was ripe for change, it needed change. was convicted and sentenced to 3 months jail. So we appealed. In those days, you couldn't appeal against the conviction because the court of appeal always said, well, the magistrate heard the evidence and saw the witnesses and is a better position to judge. And so what we did, we appealed against the sentence. Anyway, when it came before the Queensland Court of Appeal, it was a single judge, and that judge was actually a former Liberal Party member of Parliament.
Of course.
So he says, in the appeal, suddenly he says, you know, he said, I think this is a lot more serious than anyone thought. So, without any appeal by the Crown to increase it, he increased it to 6 months. So I couldn't believe it. It was just insane. So then we took it to the High Court. And in the High Court, oh, it was fun. I got to tell you a little bit. But the funny part about it was that Percy was still at liberty when that Queensland Court of Appeal thing went through. So we took it to the High Court and made a bail application in the High Court, which is extremely rare for a bail application in the High Court. So then Percy and I, the two belonged to the court, we got a free barrister. I don't remember his name. And so there was no money much in those days or anything. So eventually I thought, the only way I can talk is in the witness box. So I trundled, because also the solicitor in those days couldn't sit beside the barrister. So I'm sitting back with Percy. This I'm going to have to get here. So I went up, tugged the barrister on the gown and said, tell him we'll both give evidence. So the barrister then says, well, I'm told by my instructing solicitor that both he and the client will give evidence. Now, the judge at that time was Sir Gerald Brennan. Now, Gerald Brennan has a son, Frank Brennan, who's quite famous around the place as a Catholic priest. And he was actually a volunteer at the beginning of the Aboriginal Legal Service.
You're right.
Along with Margaret McMurdo, the president of the Court of Appeal at one stage, and VIP now, and we had a lot of great, good volunteers anyway, so I had to get in the witness box and give evidence first. Percy had to go first. Yeah, Percy went first, and I worked it in this way. I knew him so well, I knew he would tell the truth, and I would tell the truth, and we both told the truth, we were going to be right. So I waited, one waiting outside, pacing up and down. The barristers got no solicitor. He doesn't know what's going on. And so the Percy gets in the box and asked him a few questions, and the judge asked him a few questions, and then I go in. Because Sir Gerald Brennan knew me from Brisbane as a civil liberties type person, he turned to me and said, how well do you know him? Meaning Percy.
Mm.
And I said, well, I've been to his home many times. He's been to my home many times. I'd consider him a friend of mine. And he said, do you reckon he'll turn up if I give him bail? And I said, yes, I'm confident, certainly would, because he wants to argue about it anyway. He's going to turn up to challenge it, you know. And so then the prosecutor started to cross-examine me, and Brendan says, Mr. So-and-so, I'm satisfied he'll turn up. The only thing we need to know is what conditions you want on the bail. And so the judge adjourned then while we sorted out the conditions. The prosecution, this is the Queensland lawyers, wanted him to report to every police station between Canberra and Cairns. So as a legal service, we accepted the challenge. What happened was we organised a civic reception in every place he had to report, and the legal service drove him around in a convoy of cars to report, and the media were all there. And by the time it got to Percy reaching Cairns, it was international news. The media were everywhere on it, you know.
Incredible.
And then, of course, when Percy got to the police station at Yarrabah, where he had to report, he's sitting there drinking coffee. He wasn't in the cells. He was just in the lounge area with the police drinking coffee and stuff. And, sometimes people can be so bad that it rebounds on them. And so it became a terrible blight on Queensland to have done something like that. You know, everyone in the world was like, goodness me, you know, that's just rubbish, you know. And so, the fellow increased it to 6 months in the Queensland Court, but the High Court was saddled with restrictions in what they could do. So they could only get rid of the 6 months and restore the original 3 months. So Percy had to do the 3 months. But I went to the jail to visit him in Stewart Creek, And when I arrived, I said to him, how's it, how are you handling it all, you know? He said, oh, easy, good, good. He said, when I arrived, they had a civic reception for me. And when they took me to my cells, all my toiletries all laid out and everyone's been fabulous. And then when I left the jail, walked out the front door, he walked out with me. I said, where are you going? You can't walk out. He said, oh, yeah, no, nobody's worried about me. Yeah, they all think that I've been done wrong. And so I'm just going around the other side of the jail there. But I'm just walking around, so no problems. So that's the word agitators comes from Percy, because I figure all of these Aboriginal people, over all of these years that I've been working with, who were striving for change, were all agitators. But you've got to remember, one thing in the High Court was wonderful. The judge, Lionel Murphy, Lionel Murphy's quite famous. He was Attorney General in the Whitlam government. Mm. So when he became a High Court judge, so he's sitting, and he said, Oscar Wilde once said that our civilization would never have progressed without the benefit of agitators. And in all the circumstances of the conditions at Yarrabah, Mr. Neal is entitled to be an agitator. And so that's where I got, I think all these people I work with, from Pastor Brady all the way through, you know, they've been agitated. And it's a wonderful thing to be an agitator that achieves progress for your people.
Yes, yes.
And so that's what the book's about, you know.
That's the voice of Paul Richards, our guest today on Let's Talk. Paul, the J.B. Ockie Peterson years, you know, before my time and before many's.
You were lucky.
That's where I'm leading to is can you take us back to that time and, you know, the corrupt cops and the brutality that still exists today. It's still a leftover legacy from the Fitzgerald and Bjorkie Peterson period. Let's go back there.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you probably, a lot of people know, that there was quite a couple of cabinet ministers and quite a few police all went to jail because it was a corrupt state. It wasn't just the Aboriginal people that suffered. It was anyone who was a sort of a fair and decent attitude towards your fellow human being. So, I mean, funny, I used to laugh because the Cherbourg kids told me, oh, we've been over to Bjorkie Peterson's place for work experience. I said, oh, yeah, what were you doing? He said, oh, picking peanuts. I said, did they pay you? They said, no, but we were allowed to eat peanuts while we were working. I thought, that's the classic
slave labour.
Peanuts, isn't it? Yeah, slave labour.
Might as well have been picking cotton. The police in Queensland, you know, probably, is like I said before, a bit of that leftover legacy of, you know, standover tactics, particularly for black people. You know, we see it all too often down here in West End and other places. Is that something that will ever change?
I think so, yeah, I think so. I mean, because in those days it was really blatant, you know. In fact, one of my stories in my book you'll enjoy, and the person who it's about, I asked him if he wanted me to put his name in the book, because I wouldn't do that without his permission. Mm. And so the person I told was Arnie Murray. Mm. Arnie Murray is a well-known footballer and was the mayor of Cherbourg and stuff. Anyway, around about 1980, the grand final was like 2 days away, and Arnie Murray came up in the court for disorderly conduct. Him and another fellow at Cherbourg had a bit of a scuffle in the pub. No one was injured, no big drama, and it was all over. But the coppers wanted to get Arnie, and so they charged him with disorderly conduct. Now, in those days, it was $20 and 1 month to pay, standard penalty for just a bit of disorderly conduct. So, anyway, going to court, the magistrate fined him $100, no time to pay, which meant that he either had $100 on him or he was going to go into custody. So I took Arnie out into the interview room outside the court and I said, look, we'll go downstairs, we'll go to the clerk of the court, we'll lodge an appeal and we'll ask for bail from the clerk of the court, which was possible to be done. But within seconds of coming out, and before I even had a chance to say that to Arnie, the police in the room with the warrant already prepared. Now, they couldn't have possibly had the time to prepare that between when the magistrate finished talking and when they turned up standing in front of me holding the warrant. They prepared it before court. Because what had happened is the magistrate and the police used to drink together in the Kingaroy RSL Club. And, of course, that was Bjorkie Peterson's hometown, Kingaroy. He ruled the town, you know. And so, anyway, then by sheer coincidence, on that morning, on the way to court, someone paid me $100 that they owed me in cash, and I just shoved it in my pocket, so it was loose in my pocket. So when the copper said to me, "No, Mr. Richards, we've got the warrant here, the car's out there waiting with the engine running, the driver's there, he's off to Bogger Road and you're not getting him back for Saturday." That's how bold it was. And so when they said that, I said, "Well, take the f***ing money," and I shoved this $100 at him, and they had to let him go. They had no, because there's the $100 paid, what can they do? And so I just thought to myself, how, they cooked that up in the Kingaroy RSL Club because they wanted the white Kingaroy team to beat the little black team from down the road at Cherbourg in the grand final.
Disgusting. But not surprising.
The best part was going to the grand final. Because once again, Blackfella triumphed, you know. And it was funny because the coppers had to stay at the, around the bar at the football. And so every time I'd go up to get drinks, I'd say to them, "Who do you think is going to win?" And they'd say, "Oh, Kingaroy, Kingaroy." Anyway, as it went on, Cherbourg were flogging Kingaroy. And as it went on, it got worse until eventually I would go up and I'd say, "Now tell me again, who did you say? Who did you say was going to win?"
Certainly an agitator.
That was just a setup. Dreadful. Criminal. Well, it was criminal.
Criminal. Mm. Yeah. Well, look, you've got so many stories, and we'd love to have you back on and keep you on with you on a regular basis because, we certainly enjoy hearing your tales and reading them as well in this fantastic book, Adventures with Agitators by Paul Richards, our guest today on Let's Talk. Thanks so much for coming in, brother.
Thank you very much, Dan. Yeah.